It's time for Agriculture, presented by Turkana Farms in Germantown, New York, a small-scale producer of heritage breed livestock and a wide array of vegetables and berries on just over 39 acres. They also produce a full array of garden vegetables, many of them heirloom varieties raised naturally, as well as an assortment of berries, including raspberries, blackberries, gooseberries, black, red, and white currants, mulberries, and elderberries. And now, here's Mark Scherzer.
The farm seems frozen in place just now. We're in winter stasis. The young pullets that arrived in late August have not yet begun laying eggs. It's still too early to start seedlings under lights for spring. And with high temperatures in the teens and a brisk north wind, I'm in no mood to trim fruit trees and berry bushes. Contemplating the stillness brings its own pleasure. There was a slight flurry of activity while my partner Eric and I were in Quebec and our friends Arthur and Bernard were farm-sitting. Two lambs were born on December 27th. The yearling has been named Bern Arthur in their honor. These are very early births. Apparently, Suleiman IV, this year's ram, had just reached breeding capacity when a few cool nights in early August triggered a surge in his hormones. Cool weather, as you know, makes for sexual hanky-panky. It's a phenomenon of animal husbandry fully explored by that noted zoologist, Dr. Cole Porter, in his treatise, It's Too Darn Hot. Suleiman's hormonal calendar synchronized with that of two ewes he was big enough to mount at that time. But I don't expect the annual lambalanche of daily births to start until early February, which is roughly 155 days after Labor Day, when the nights got consistently cooler, Suleiman got bigger, and the ewes next got their group menstrual cycle. Ready for all. So it's a quiet time, a focus on cozy indoor activities. This Saturday night, with the wind whistling outside and Eric in the city, I lit a fire and continued reading the book I've been eagerly chomping on in small bites since Christmas, Champlain's Dream by David Hackett Fisher. Fisher's a prolific historian, keenly sensitive to granular detail, and a great storyteller. I have an enduring respect for his book Albion's Seed, in which he traces American regional practices, such as different levels of funding for public education, to cultural norms in the different parts of England from which the region's first European settlers came. As to Samuel de Champlain, Americans know little more of him than that he was a French explorer, after whom a big lake is named. That's because we learn history mostly through the prism of the 13 English colonies and how they grew into the USA. Neighboring regions are discussed only to the extent that we fought them, say the French and Indian War or the Alamo, or subsumed them, like the Louisiana Purchase. I wanted something else. I figured Fisher's book on Champlain would help me better understand the history of Quebec, where Eric was born and raised, and also its current vibrant culture, which Eric so loves and which I've so loved coming to know through him. I did not anticipate that the book would resonate with current geopolitical issues, but it does. Fisher starts by describing the political environment in which Champlain's explorations arose. During the second half of the 16th century, French Catholics and Protestants slaughtered each other in 9 civil wars, including brutal pogroms. Hundreds of thousands died. Henry IV, the first Bourbon monarch of France, and likely Champlain's father through an illegitimate union, came to the throne in 1589 and ultimately ended that strife through a policy of tolerance and a guarantee of prosperity to all, regardless of religious affiliation. When he was criticized for buying loyalty from his subjects, he responded that it was far cheaper to buy loyalty than to enforce it through the sword. Champlain operated out of similar humanistic instincts. Repulsed by the oppression he saw in Spanish colonies he had visited, including forced labor by indigenous populations, he set out, with Henry IV's blessing, to create a different model of colonization in Canada, a culture of collaboration with native peoples, whom he respected as equals. for all the inequities to which First Nations have been subject in Canada, Fisher concludes that the basic approach and tone set by Champlain had positive effects. It seems to me reflected in the very much greater respect and influence the Autochtones of Canada enjoy today, as compared with the most of the rest of the Americas. It all made me think, where are the Henry IVs and Champlains when the world needs them? But reading about Champlain's first colonizing voyage in 1604 brought my focus back from the larger world to the farm. On the boats in Champlain's small fleet, Fisher tells us, were both chickens and sheep. You see, humans are not the only European colonial settlers of this land. Sheep are, too. Indeed, even the famed Navajo Churro sheep, one bloodline in the ancestry of this farm's American caracoles, descend from sheep brought to Mexico by Coronado in the 1540s. I suspect sheep and chickens were included on Champlain's boat for the same reason they are my mainstays on the farm. They are relatively small, relatively manageable, and they produce food quickly. Fisher compassionately speculates about the critter's reaction to a stormy, tumultuous ocean crossing. I had assumed they were kept in the dark ship's hold and would be miserable even on a calm voyage. But it seems that on ships of the 1600s, sheep would have been kept in outdoor pens on the gun deck. That would explain how a sheep could go overboard on this voyage. Fisher, the cautious historian, doesn't tell us exactly how this happened. But according to local lore, as they approached land, the sheep got excited for the pasture it saw, jumped ship, and swam to shore. It was slaughtered at Champlain's direction for a feast, and that is how the settlement of Port Mouton, Port Mutton, Nova Scotia, got its name. The local lore makes sense to me. Even if recently fed, my sheep will knock me and any other sheep out of their way in their mad dash for favored food. I can certainly believe that after 4 weeks at sea, on a diet of undoubtedly degraded hay, a sheep would jump ship and swim at the sight of good pasture. Good and ample food, water, and shelter, the common needs of sheep and humans, go a long way to keeping the peace.
Agriculture is underwritten by Tricana Farms, LLC, a small-scale producer of heritage-bred livestock and a wide array of vegetables and berries on just over 39 acres in Germantown, New York. More information, 518-537-3815.